Hi, everyone. I'm Anita Lustria, and in my world, conversation is king. A number of years ago, when I lost my big job of being a radio talk show host, I decided I could mope around and be sad. Okay, I did a bunch of that. Or I could move on and start a podcast so I could keep the conversation going. That's how this podcast was born. As you listen, you'll hear about things that are important to me, and hopefully you'll resonate with these topics as well. Welcome to Faith Conversations. On the podcast today, I'm delighted to have Shay Tuttle. She is co-editor of Can I Get a Witness? 13 Peacemakers, Community Builders, and Agitators for Faith and Justice. I especially like that title. She holds an MDiv from Candler School of Theology at Emory University, and she lives in Virginia with her family currently. And I'm really thrilled to welcome her to the podcast, Faith Conversations. Welcome, Shay.
Thank you.
Shay is the author of Exactly As You Are, The Life and Faith of Mr. Rogers. I would love to hear from people. I'll toss out the email address right here at the beginning. Many of you who listen regularly know, producer@anitalustria.com. I would love to hear from you about your experience of Mr. Rogers. If you grew up, or if you grew up with your children watching Mr. Rogers. But obviously, Mr. Rogers has been in the news a lot, maybe over the last couple of years, because there was a documentary, and then, of course, the movie that many have attended, starring Tom Hanks. But Exactly As You Are, The Life and Faith of Mr. Rogers, is Shay Tuttle's book. And I want to know from you, Shay, what your experience of Mr. Rogers was, if you watched him as a child. And how you became interested enough to write a book.
Yeah. So I did watch him as a child. When I was very young, I was quite devoted. I remember being very upset if I had to miss, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. I would cry. I think I was not alone in that, as some young children go. But, I adored him as a kid. And in early stages of writing this book, I thought a lot about, What was that about? What did I love so much about him? And why did I feel this kind of deep connection? And then I think I kind of maintained that affection for him even as I grew older, and even when I didn't watch it anymore. I think anytime he was mentioned, it would be sort of, oh, Mr. Rogers, I love Mr. Rogers. And then I think my interest was kind of rekindled at some point when I actually came across the Esquire magazine profile that the Tom Hanks film is based loosely
you
on.
You did. My husband looked it up and read it and said it was just wonderful. And I have not done that yet.
It's fabulous. And I didn't read it when it came out. I think it came out in 98. I don't know how. I wish I remembered how I discovered it. At the time I read it, it was tucked away in some kind of Esquire magazine online archive. I remember the formatting was ugly. They were not pushing the story at the time. I think it was probably around 2011 or 2012. And I read it and I just thought, oh my gosh, like as an adult, it was my first time encountering, like, there's a lot to this person. And it was also, I think, the first time I got any sense that faith was a really big part of Fred Rogers' life and personality, though I think that was present in the show. That's not something I was tuned into as a child.
Right. So, I don't think I was either.
Yeah. And he did that in very, usually very subtle ways anyway. He wasn't making that overt.
Right.
So it just, that made me curious. And I think over time, I just kind of carried that curiosity. There was a point a few years ago when I was working on the book you referenced, the Can I Get a Witness book, which I edited, but at some point I had a conversation with one of my co-editors when he asked me, who would you write about for this book if you were going to write about someone? And I was like, I don't know. I'm not like a history person. That's not kind of how my mind works. And then it was, I think that day driving home from work, I thought, oh my gosh, Mr. Rogers. And so I started learning about him, wondering if I might write a chapter or an essay or an article, and just realized, oh my gosh, there's so much to say, that it kept growing.
Oh, interesting, and became a book.
Yeah.
I love it. And actually, I need to say this because I realized when I introduced you, What is not written in your bio in the flyleaf of the book is that you're a Hope College graduate.
I am.
And so I want to mention that because how I became acquainted with your book, my husband's son, Stephen, is a Hope, and actually a daughter-in-law too, both Hope College graduates. And so we receive the monthly Hope College magazine.
Oh, great.
I can't even remember what it's called, but there was a big article in it about you and the book. And it arrived at our home, I think the day or the day before we went to see the Tom Hanks Mr. Rogers movie.
Oh, that's great.
And so, nice. You know, came home and read that immediately. And I thought, whoa, I got to get her on the podcast. This is great.
That's great.
Yeah. I have not watched the documentary. I've had people recommend the documentary to me. Is that good watching? Is that worth seeing?
Oh, I love it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I actually, I liked it when I saw it even the first time, but every time I see it, my appreciation for it deepens. I think they, Fred Rogers was a very complicated person. I think they managed to get to a lot of things about him that are really, you know, key. Yeah. And so, yeah, I like it a lot.
Okay.
I think it's really beautifully done.
I'll have to go back and see that. I think people can still catch the movie in some theaters, you know, even now, but I know they can get it on demand, certainly, at this point. You know, when you're looking at a figure like Fred Rogers, who is so complex and has such an interesting story of how, of his own personal development and interest in children and such an affection for children and who had a real gift for communicating well with children. I mean, where do you begin when you're writing a book about a complex character like a Fred Rogers? I mean, how did you decide where you start with a story like this?
Yeah, honestly, I don't know. And I felt the whole time like I didn't know what in the world I was doing. You know, it was terrifying. Because I was diving into this topic that I really was excited about. I mean, if you could have told me as a child that I would someday write a book about Mr. Rogers, I would have just been, you know, so delighted. I wouldn't have been able to stand it. So I was really excited to be doing this, but I felt like I had no clue what I was doing. And I kept thinking like, oh man, I should have saved this topic for later when I actually know how to do this, you know?
I love it.
So I just started with like, I read a couple books about him and then I started contacting people who knew him.
Nice. Yeah.
And they would connect me to somebody else. And everyone I talked to, I would say, who else do I need to talk to?
Right.
So that was a big part of it. And then pretty early on realized I needed to go to Pittsburgh and Latrobe, which is his hometown where he grew up, and visit the archive and look through things. And so I did that, and that was really important. And so kind of between like talking to people and then gathering as many documents that were, you know, his writing, watching episodes in the neighborhood, watching interviews with him. I think I transcribed all 4.5 hours of the Emmy archive interview, you know, because it just, and that was incredibly, you know, once it was transcribed, it was searchable. That was really useful. So I'm sure people have really different processes, but I felt like I had to gather as much as I could, first until I felt like I kind of had a sense of him before I could start to think about what to do with any of that. I wanted to feel like I knew him, and in moments I did, and in moments I knew that I totally didn't. And that's still how I feel. But, I wanted, I don't know if, well, I didn't mean to write a biography anyway, but somehow I sort of did. And I don't know if biographers tend to approach their subjects that way, that like, I want to get to know this person as if we were in a real relationship. I think some don't, but that's how I felt as I approached it.
Well, I personally liked your approach, and I love the whole first section of the book is labeled Becoming Mr. Rogers, because I think it's so helpful to get this sense of how he became Mr. Rogers, exactly as you titled it. Looking at those, his early years, some of his loneliness, I loved hearing about him going to Dartmouth and it was just not a fit at all, and where he finally ended up at Rollins, which is not that far from where I am here in Sarasota. It's in kind of like the Orlando area, I think, isn't it? And then his musical side, you know, coming out, the whole musical expression that starts happening at Rollins, because here he is at Dartmouth, and they didn't have a music major yet at the school, which I thought was right. really interesting. Mm-hmm. And he was just starting to figure out that that might be what he wanted to pay attention to, at least at one point. Obviously, we know that he went on and got a theological education as well, but this is all layered in and doesn't happen all at once.
Right.
But he did meet Joanne, his wife, at Rollins. So making that switch from Dartmouth to Rollins, pretty important in the scheme of his life, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, and a lot of friends that he met at Rollins were important for the rest of his life. Yeah, that first section of the book, at some point I came to think of as origin stories, mm-hmm. Because I knew I wasn't going to do a sort of chronological look at his entire life. But those stories were the stories that I found that he told again and again in different contexts to explain himself and his work. And so it seems to me that lots of other things happened to him during those years, but those were the things that he held on to because they somehow were formative in a way that he wanted to convey. And so, it seemed like each of those stories, part of what I tried to do was to think about why did he keep telling this? What was this about as it relates to the work he eventually did through Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood?
Well, and in that sense, right, why did he keep saying certain things, telling certain stories? Well, let's talk about your title, Exactly As You Are. Mm-hmm. This certainly is a key and core message of Fred Rogers. And as you started researching, did you just keep hearing that over and over or seeing that? Talk about that message and the importance of that message that he regularly gave, not just to children, but really to all of us.
To everybody, yeah, that's right. You know, the title, oddly enough, came very late, and it came after much, it was such a process. I came across the other day some of my many lists of ideas and like, what about this word or what about this idea for title? I went back and forth with my editor and a bunch of people at the publisher and a bunch of my friends. I mean, just on and on to try to figure out what the right title was. My working title was something quite different. We had gone around so many times and tried out so many things. And finally, at the publisher, they had a meeting that I was not in. And they came out of the meeting and sent me an email and said, this is it. You can argue if you really disagree, but we're pretty sure this is it because we think it's really good. And I read it and I was like, okay. And the longer I've lived with it, the more that I've realized it's perfect, because I do think that the core of Fred's theology is that God loves us exactly as we are. And so I think that's the message then that he took into his work with, like you said, children, but everybody else too. That we are good and that we are lovable exactly as we are. And he would qualify that, you know, he talked about how he saw the message of Jesus as, I love you just the way you are. Now let's grow together from there. Right. So, of course, growing was very important to Mr. Rogers, but I think it was still fundamental to him that we start with affirmation. Yes. And that comes from a place that's very, for him, theological. But he believed that it was also efficacious, that if we start with understanding that we are good and that we are lovable, then we'll treat other people as if they are lovable too. Right. And so, I think that was at the center of everything he did. And so I'm thrilled that it was the eventual title of the book. It just took a long time to get there.
It's interesting. I wrote a few notes in the margins in a couple of places, and one of them was, you know, really at a point early on in the book where you're sort of outlining Fred's words and really it's right at the end of adolescence and acceptance, that whole thing, because he himself was bullied, wasn't he, as a young man. I wonder how much of that also came into play with why he was interested in caring for the souls of children. I think that was probably certainly a part of it, right?
I think so too. Mm-hmm.
So I found in my notes that I wrote down here that I watched and cried almost daily as I was going through postpartum depression with my first child. And so my son at that point was way too little to take in Fred Rogers at all, but I would lay on the sofa and I would watch Mr. Rogers.
Oh, that's great.
And I would just cry because I was depressed, and I would hear the beautiful message that the affirmation, as you said, that I was loved just as I was, even in this state that I didn't even fully understand at the time. Right. So it was just interesting that that came back to me as I was reading your book.
What a testament to the work that he did. And I've heard that from other people too, who watched as adults and at some point realized that they were starting to believe him when he said that he liked them just the way they were. It's like, I think that's, they felt that that was a true thing. Which is pretty remarkable that it has that power, even, you know, long after his death, that we encounter him and we feel actually liked. Just the way we are.
Well, and I was just thinking about this too. I'm a spiritual director, and have had clients whose significant struggle is believing that they are loved. And I remember coming home after the movie, going to see the Tom Hanks movie, and thinking, all right, I think that these clients need to watch some Mr. Rogers shows over and over and over. It's hard. It's sometimes a hard message for us to take in and to truly believe. So I think there's just so much to the truth of that. The other thing that I made note of early on, just in Fred's life, but also in, you know, in what happened on the television program, what he did really was to teach spiritual practices to his audience, child and adult alike. But people just didn't know that. You know, I think he was teaching spiritual practices all the time.
I think so too. I mean, I think the kind of shape of the show had a liturgy about it. Fred also was a very disciplined person and kept his own kind of personal liturgies very religiously. So I think there's, you referenced earlier the importance of music in his life. And I told someone recently, you know, I approached his life through this lens of theology. I almost feel like someone could write his life through the lens of music and it would be equally central to who he was. That was such a key part of who he was. And when you think about music and about music instruction and music, the discipline that it requires to be a musician, I think that also formed the kind of shape of his program. But yeah, I think he took all of these different pieces, his learning about child development and how routine serves children, and his understanding of music as a musician himself, and then his experience in religious communities of keeping liturgies and the ways that those formed him. And he built a show that had some really strong liturgies that were forming the viewer in these routines. And yeah, I think there are really interesting connections to a kind of spiritual discipline focus there too.
One chapter in the book is called Neighborhood Liturgy. And you begin by saying children are creatures of liturgy. For that matter, so are adults, to what you were just talking about. We humans respond very well to routine. Some of us crave it, even require it. And Mr. Rogers really leaned into that with what he did. I'm looking for something else that I just recently underlined, and I hope I can find it. But maybe this is a part of it. One of the things that Mr. Rogers did, like, let's move ahead and talk about when the program did start. There, you have great information about him developing who he was, and also he did this program first in Pittsburgh called, was it Children's Corner? What was it?
Yeah,
was that
the
it?
Children's Corner.
So he developed and learned more and more about television, obviously, in that format and forum.
Right.
And then eventually went to Canada and did a program there where he, again, he expected to be behind the scenes, but that's where he was put on camera.
Right.
And didn't expect that, but I don't know how much he balked. That's not what he thought he was going to do, but he said yes.
Right.
And I think that's where he found that he really liked that and connected. Is that true?
Yeah. It's funny. I mean, the way he tells the story is that he went to Canada thinking he would do what he did on the Children's Corner, which is puppets and music. So he was performing, but it wasn't his face showing, other than on a couple of occasions where he was a special character or something. The way he told the story was that he like got all the way to Canada before his friend was, I want to say his name was also Fred. Before his friend said, who had sort of hired him to do this, like, so I want you to be in front of the camera, and that he was startled by that. It's a little hard for me to believe that that's exactly how it happened. But I think for him, it was this sort of leap whenever it happened to start thinking about himself in front of the camera. But his friend said to him, I've seen you talk to children. Mm-hmm. I think this will be really good. And at the time, Fred had two young children, but I think also had encountered children constantly through his work on the Children's Corner, and his, you know, this friend of his saw something special happening there that he wanted to lean into.
And his name was Fred Rainsbury.
That
called him to Canada. One of the other things that I made note of, and this was probably early in the book, I don't know. Fred Rogers was absolutely appalled at the children's programming that he saw coming out on television.
Right.
And he thought, I want no part of this. I do not want anything I do to even remotely look like this. I think at one point he made a trip to Russia to help with some kind of children's programming, and they pulled out a kind of format. I think they talked to him about like a Tom and Jerry type of show, and he would have no part of that and did not stay any time, and he was back home.
Yeah. There was some conversation where someone referred. He did work in Russia, but I think this may have been somewhere else. I can't remember. But yeah, someone said something like Tom and Jerry, and he said, I don't like Tom and Jerry, which I just like how clear he was.
I love
about
it.
That.
Yeah.
And I think they developed something else, but yeah, he decided to go, the way he tells the story anyway, that he decided to go into television instead of going to seminary out of college because he saw television for the first time and thought it was awful. So it was, you know, people throwing pies in other people's faces, and he thought it was demeaning. And I think out of that experience being bullied as a child, he hated anything that felt demeaning. But somehow he also kind of immediately intuited the power of this medium and wanted to use it for something else. But he continued to, I think, very much dislike most animated programming. I think especially when you think about like Looney Tunes style stuff, where people just keep getting like, you know, hit with a hammer and they flatten and then they pop back up and then they run around and then they get, you know, blown up with dynamite. He hated that stuff. I think for lots of reasons.
Yes.
It was, you know, unrealistic. It was violent. It had nothing to do with child development or children's emotions. I mean, he hated it.
And he really tuned into children's emotions and child development. Yeah. I was reading where he, I'm trying to think where this was in the book, but he was working with a child development specialist.
Mm-hmm. Margaret McFarland.
And Margaret, I don't know how this came about, but she was talking to a potter, someone who working with clay, mm-hmm. and said, you know, don't tell them how to make something. Show them yourself working with the clay. Love the clay as you work with it.
Right.
And I thought that was just beautifully said. And Fred, you know, really grabbed onto that. And she was the one that taught him, said to him, you know, so much more is caught than taught when you're working with children.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think that was hugely influential. And, you know, when you think about, the episodes of The Neighborhood, I mean, so many episodes, he goes to visit someone to witness them doing their craft. And many times for him, it was the arts because he was passionate about the arts. But sometimes it was other things, too, when you think about episodes where he went to the weather station or the dairy farm or whatever. And he would go and just sort of witness people doing what they love to do. And I think for him, that was all about letting children see people loving their work so that children could find their way into their own self-expression.
Yes. How long did Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood run?
So first national episodes were in 1968, And I think the last new episodes were around, I want to say 2000, 2001.
Really?
So that's over 30 years.
Wow. I don't think I realized that.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's that or it's very close to that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, over 30 years.
And what I'm not aware of, and I don't know if you are or not, but are they being re-aired even now on public television or no?
I don't think they're being aired like on PBS, but there are quite a few episodes available on Amazon Prime that are included in Prime if you have Prime.
Yeah.
And then there are a lot more on Amazon that you can buy for a couple dollars if you want to see them. Or if you're like a PBS Kids subscriber, you can see even more.
Okay.
So a lot of them are out there.
So they're out there and available.
Yeah, not all, but many are available, so which is nice.
Do you think Mr. Rogers, that his children's show connected with a certain kind of child, or was it really universal to most children? What's your thought on that?
You know, my sense has been in just talking about him with people, and then when people find out that I'm writing about him, you know, the responses are pretty consistent. Occasionally you come across someone who says, oh, I didn't watch that growing up, or I was more of a Sesame Street kid or whatever. But I don't think there was a type of child. I mean, I think to some extent, maybe there was kind of an age limit or a developmental limit where I think there's a point when kids, I can say that my own children watched a lot with me as I was researching. It made it really nice to say, I need to get work done. Let's go watch a show, you know? And they loved it. And they're now 6 and 9. So they're a little out of the age range now that Fred was really catering to. But there was a point watching, I don't remember what the episode was or exactly what was going on, but somewhere where Fred like got very, you know, did his kind of sermonic, like look right into the camera and speak to you very directly and was talking about something sort of vulnerable feelings or whatever. And my daughter, who's older, said something like, Mom, he's making me kind of embarrassed. And so I think there's an age where kids don't question that kind of very intimate, straight on conversation because that's the way kids communicate. And then at some point, many kids cross into a time when that has to be a little more mediated or it's uncomfortable. And a lot of adults live there too.
Yes.
But I think for adults who watch with their children or who did watch with their children, sometimes they can sort of tolerate that because they can see it as something that's
not for them. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's for a different audience, so you can tolerate
it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. So I think there's kind of a, I don't know, there are times I think children move in and out of maybe receptivity to what he's doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But also, you know, he heard from teenagers who were like, so I was babysitting and I saw your show and you actually seemed like you liked me. And, you know, and so it meant a lot. I think it can mean a lot at all ages too, if it hits in the right kind of moment.
In the right kind of moment. Isn't that the truth? That's fascinating. I love it.
Yeah.
So what's interesting to me too, is that he started, his first national broadcast was 1968. So he's coming on the air during a very interesting time, even in the history of the United States.
That's right.
You know, we're talking Vietnam War. We're talking race riots as well, and all kinds of things. How did Fred Rogers deal with that, or did he bring some of that to the program?
Yeah, he sure did. And I think I was really influenced here by Michael G. Long's book, which is called Peaceful Neighbor, Discovering the Countercultural Mr. Rogers. He did a really amazing job of kind of going back. I mean, I think of his book a little bit like an exegesis. He took the episodes. I think he watched tons and tons of episodes. And he kind of put them back into their context of when they first aired. And so he was able to see these ways that Fred was responding very directly to what was happening in the political landscape. I think Fred knew that children were either seeing television news or they were sensing from their parents the tensions that their parents were carrying, and that adults oftentimes aren't great at talking to children about that. And so Fred wanted to mediate that a little bit. I think he also just wanted to express what he thought was true and right. So for instance, you know, 1968, were months just months before Dr. King is murdered. Right. And he has the first episode ever that's nationally televised. There's a group of school children that come to visit him at his home. And maybe four or five children and their teacher, and they sit at the kitchen table and they sing together. But the teacher is African American, and the children, some are white and some are black. Mm. And so first thing out of the gate, he gives this image of like, this is what's normal, though it wasn't everywhere in 1968. But for him, in Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, integrated classrooms and integrated schools are normal. And of course, there's also, you know, the famous scene with Francois Clemens, who was one of the first African American recurring characters on a children's television show. He came on, I think, later in 68 or 69. But he was Officer Clemens. And there's the scene where Fred invites him to cool his feet in the water in the pool.
Oh, that's right.
And this is coming pretty closely on the heels of major events in the news, I think out of Florida, where, you know, people are protesting segregated swimming pools.
Yes.
And they jump in the water and there's acid poured into the water and all of this. And Fred, just in his quiet way to children, just says, not here. Like, here, we sit together, our feet are in the same, there's this close-up shot of, dark feet and these really pasty pale Mr. Rogers feet next to each other in the water. And then, like, they share a towel when they get out of the water. And so he very deliberately is giving these alternate images of what neighborhood looks like. And he's not saying, listen, let me tell you about segregation, it's evil,
right.
But he's showing what he believes is right. And he had storylines too that were very radical about war and peace in the first week and then again in the 80s that are just stunning. I mean, they're mind-blowing. They're very creative and they're very radical. And they got him in trouble a little bit.
Did they? I wondered. And what did trouble mean or look like?
Well, I think, for him, he always was kind of walking this line of, I think he wanted to represent what he believed was true. And for him, I think a lot of that was rooted in a kind of gospel vision of, a sort of surprising, the power gets upended, where you have the people on the margins are the people who come to the center. And so I think it was important to him to represent that and to express his pacifism and other things. But he also, he never wanted to do things that would kind of push it so much that he would lose viewers. I think he didn't want children to feel excluded or their parents to get so upset they wouldn't let him watch, because he wanted children to be, to have access to the neighborhood. And so, so I know that the series he did in the 80s, early 80s, that is really a kind of arms race in the neighborhood of make believe. It's my favorite narrative he ever created, where King Friday thinks that the neighboring town of Southwood is building bombs. It's incredible.
Wow.
And so, because they have ordered 1 million parts. And so in response, King Friday orders 1,000,001 parts and starts putting neighborhood residents to work, building bombs in the castle. I mean, it's incredible. So this storyline got Fred in enough trouble that he eventually pulled it, and he doesn't, they don't air it now. I don't think it's available anywhere that's sanctioned.
Wow.
It's out there if you dig.
Okay.
But it's, at some point he decided that he didn't want to air it anymore. And so I'm not sure if that was a threat of pulling funding or if it was just that he got enough angry letters or exactly how that unfolded for him. But I think it aired, a handful of times and that was it. But it's stunning. I mean, it's so good.
Wow.
So he did approach these things in his very Mr. Rogers creative, thoughtful way. Though he was never marching in the streets, he was doing his own kind of resistance.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. Yeah. Doing his own kind of resistance. Absolutely.
Yeah.
We've kind of talked about the early part, becoming Mr. Rogers and some of his background, and I've talked through some of the broadcasting grace section, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. What about the whole section of the book, the final section of the book, which is finding Fred Rogers, Hello Neighbor. And you know, Fred always had puppets. I'd love for you to say something about puppets. Fred always had puppets, and in the Tom Hanks movie and that depiction of Fred Rogers, you know, he carried him around in a suitcase. Sometimes he would have him with him just in case he might need to pull them out for a certain kind of conversation with somebody. I mean, it was fascinating to me. Say something about what you learned about Fred Rogers and puppets.
Yeah. So, you know, this is one of those places where I feel like it's important to remember that he was really strange, you know. it's easy kind of in memory to make him into this like, oh, it's very sweet and cute and nice and whatever. But like, he was weird. And I think that's important.
Quirky. Quirky a good word?
For sure. Yeah. For sure. Yeah. I think, you know, that's part of what made him magnetic. It's part of what made him, I think, able to risk things that lots of adults wouldn't risk.
Okay.
But yeah, I think the puppets thing was part of it. I think I always feel this kind of paradox about Fred Rogers, that on the one hand, he was very available. We have, you know, hours and hours of him on camera. He worked hard to be the same on camera as off camera. And people who knew him say that he was. But on the other hand, I feel like he's kind of obscured. I find it hard to really feel like I totally have a clear sense of him. I think he was sort of a little bit protective about himself and about some of his maybe more complicated feelings of anger or sadness or whatever. So I think in some ways, you know, he's visible, and in other ways he's hidden. But the puppets are a place where a lot of what's hidden, I think, starts to show. Mm. And he would say frequently that each of the puppets was a different aspect of his personality. I think, and different people who know him will say that too, although they'll emphasize different puppets. So his wife, Joanne, emphasizes Daniel and says, Daniel is really Fred, you know, just Daniel is sort of afraid, sometimes self-doubting, but curious and kind and, you know, all of this. And I think he was Daniel in lots of ways. There are people who worked with him who say, yeah, Daniel, okay, but he was King Friday, and that like, he could be domineering and he could be controlling. I think.
Well, because he got his way almost all the time, as I'm reading through the book, right?
Yes.
You've got to have drive, and you've got to, some of the attributes you just gave to King Friday. I mean, you have to be that in order to make it in that television world, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think he had this incredible vision and clarity about what he wanted to do. And so he was pretty insistent on that. You know, it's like, it's the two sides of the same coin. Like, it was a gift, but I think it also made him really tough to work with sometimes. Mm-hmm. Because he would listen to input and he would consider it. But then ultimately, he was going to do what he was going to do. Nothing was finished till he said it was finished. You know, the cut wasn't approved until he said, you know, it was very much his show. And then I think, you know, there's Cornflake especially, who has the factory. You know, Fred grew up in a factory town, and his father owned these factories and was a kind of industrialist in the town. So I think that's an important part of who he was. There's Edgar Cook, who sings everything. That's part of who he was. You get Lady Elaine Fairchild, who is such an interesting puppet and gets very interesting reactions out of people. Lots of people really don't like her. But he referred to her as not just a troublemaker, but the fun maker.
And interesting. She used to bug me. I was not a fan of her.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, she quite literally turned things upside down with her boomerang. She would turn the neighborhood of make-believe upside down, or parts of it. Mm-hmm. And you think about Fred, some of that agitating work that he was doing quietly, he was a troublemaker. He was turning things on their heads. He always talked about X the Owl as the adolescent version of him, which I think is interesting. Huh. Although I think X just comes off a little dopey, so I don't know what to make of that. But,
well, I think one of the things that I think of when I think of Lady Elaine and just the different puppets is he had this message, overarching message, you know, you're loved exactly as you are, but he didn't shy away from, you know, like the Lady Elaine characters in our world.
Yeah.
The show is not one-sided emotionally. I mean, the whole range, which I'm so grateful for that. I mean, smart and well done, because that's real life.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. There are annoying characters in all of our lives.
That's right. Yeah.
And people that turn things upside down. That's really funny.
Yeah, well, and she was named for his sister, which I think is also very interesting. That, you know, Fred was an only child until he was 11, and then his baby sister was adopted. And I think when people would push him on it, he would kind of dodge it a little bit, but like, he named the annoying puppet after his baby sister.
Say no more.
Took away
Talk
his
about,
parents' attention.
That's right. Yeah. We're turning the world upside down. The boomerang thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's pretty deep.
Talk about Fred's big feelings. You know, he did a ton of emotional work on the show, and was very adept at. And I loved how he would describe feelings and also give ways that children could. Have outlets for some of the more difficult feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that. You devote a whole chapter to Fred's big feelings.
Yeah. So I think some of Fred's, I think he's complicated, right? I keep coming back to that, but I think he was sort of a complicated character when it came to feelings. He had this level of emotional intelligence that allowed him to speak with children so meaningfully about their feelings and to acknowledge children's feelings as real and as, actually having weight and bearing, which lots of adults kind of skip over because that's convenient. And he also, I think, really struggled in his own life to do what he was encouraging the children to do, which is to express what he felt in ways that were useful. And of course, you know, he did in ways. He expressed through music, or he talked about how he would express his anger, for instance, through swimming. So I think he found ways privately to do that, but interpersonally he struggled. He talked constantly about anger. He would quote Margaret McFarland, who we talked about before, as saying, "Anything human is mentionable, and anything mentionable is manageable." So he would encourage people to talk about feelings, but he was terrible at it. And so
his
wife, I mean, she has said, even in recent years, that they never really learned how to argue. If they were angry, they would just kind of get quiet. So I think he struggled with that. And that happened. I've heard similar things from other people who worked with him. In that chapter, I think I write about anger. There's a section about sadness. I think Fred carried a lot of grief, and some of that was, you know, things that happened in his own life as we all kind of encounter losses and things. Some of that too, I imagine, was that he heard from so many people about their own griefs and losses, because people felt a kinship with him when they watched The Neighborhood, and they would write to him about things. And so he carried a lot of grief. And often I found it really interesting when I would talk to people who knew him, it was so important to me to try to make him a real person and not sort of perfect. So I would ask them, like, okay, he wasn't a saint. So can you tell me what made him human? And I was expecting people to say, oh, well, he did this thing one time that wasn't very nice, or whatever, some kind of failing. Almost every time they told me a story about him crying.
Huh.
And so their way of seeing him as human was that he felt very deeply.
Deep emotions. Huh. Okay.
Yeah. And then he also wrestled with a lot of self-doubt. And he made some notes to himself that are kind of stunning in their, and how raw they are about thinking, just not being sure that he could create new episodes, even though he'd done it a dozen times,
wow.
You know, just to be able to, he talked about creation as, like, the tortures of the damned. I mean, he just, he found it agonizing, which I found super encouraging in the middle of writing.
For sure.
But yeah, he doubted whether his work was really having an impact, which right now seems pretty funny. He's everywhere, you know.
How about a couple more questions here? I don't want to keep you forever. I love this. How did he relate to his own children? A lot of times seems to be kind of a tough space for someone who relates really well to other people's children. And
right.
Yeah. So what did that look like in Fred Rogers' life?
Yeah. You know, I don't know a whole lot about his family and some of those relationships. I think the family has always been pretty protective about a lot of that. What I do know, or what I've gathered, is that those were some kind of difficult relationships at times. I mean, I guess all parent-child relationships can be, but I think it may be that as his children kind of outgrew the age that he had studied so much, it just got harder, and especially when they became teenagers. I mean, Maxwell King's biography, he writes about sometime when his sons were teenagers and Fred got home and saw a weird light coming from the basement and went and found like grow lights on marijuana plants, you know, so like, and that I think in King's telling, Fred didn't handle it very well, you know, that he kind of struggled to know how to react to things like that.
Yeah.
So I think that was tough. And I think it's really interesting that in the documentary, both of his sons participated as well as his wife, Joanne. And I don't think they've done a lot of media before now. So it was a big deal, I think, that they agreed to do it. But his younger son, John, said something in the documentary that just I found really striking. He said something like, "Sometimes I still wonder what made my dad tick." And I just think, like, you know, even after a full, you know, a lifetime with his father, he still finds him a little puzzling, which I guess is, I found that a little comforting that I find him a little puzzling too. Yeah. But so I think the relationship was complicated. I think it was loving because,
sure,
you know, all indications are that it was loving,
right.
But I think it was a struggle.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Final question, I guess. It was August of 2001, when Fred's last episodes of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood aired. And no, it's interesting. I read in your book, nowhere in the 5-episode series of that last week does Mr. Rogers acknowledge that it is the final week. Mm-hmm. What did you learn about that? Because, Mr. Rogers taught so many how to express emotions and I would think this would be a kind of a difficult thing for him and for the audience, even while I realize that audience changes year to year to year because they're growing children. I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
How did he decide that, or what do you know about that?
So it's my understanding that he, you know, that was the first time a brand new episode series aired, but the show didn't go off the air. So as you know, it had always been.
Which makes it complicated because it's not, the show is still going on, even though these are the last new episodes. So how do you handle that? Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. And he wanted to see that you know, I think it was his hope that they had created a kind of catalog that could keep playing and that, you know, it would move to different points in time and he would be different ages or whatever, but that they could, most of his shows were filmed in these 5-episode series. And so they could go back and air previous ones. And most years, I mean, the early years of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, he made a ton of new content, but many years later, he only made maybe 3 new weeks, sometimes 2 or 1 new week of content.
Okay.
So they were always recycling old episodes in with the new.
All right.
So this was really like, you know, we close the door Friday, but Monday it's going to open again and he'll be there. It'll just be an episode that's been on before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, when you have an audience that, you know, cycles through and ages out, it's okay. You can do that. And also children love seeing things over and over. That's the other thing going for you with children's programming, right?
Yeah.
How old was Fred when he died? I think I was reading 75?
I want to say 74, 75. I think he was a little bit short of his 75th birthday, if I'm remembering right.
Okay.
So not old enough, you know?
Wow.
Yeah.
Glad you wrote the book.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
You know,
anything that you feel you would like to explore more about Fred Rogers, as you wrote the book and, you know, your book has its own arc, anything that you came across that you thought, oh, I'd like to go down this path a little bit longer, but it doesn't necessarily fit into the book.
Oh gosh. I mean, for me, he feels unendingly interesting. And I don't really feel like I'm done with him yet. I don't know what that means, but I've kind of thought about, you know, what's the next project or what do I want to dig into? And it seems like every time I try to dig into like, well, maybe this, then I end up going back and like writing more about Fred. I mean, I think I still just find him so interesting. And I find the interest in him very interesting culturally of what's happening. Why are we drawn to him? You know, all of that.
Why now? Why? Yeah.
Exactly.
Why Fred? Why now?
Yeah.
How do you think you're a better person having learned more and look, you know, having dug into the life of Fred Rogers?
I don't know. I think, I mean, I've reflected sometimes on what it's been like to learn a lot about Fred Rogers and spend a lot of time with Fred Rogers in the years when I have young children.
Yeah.
It's in ways it makes, I'm sure I would think it probably in some ways gives me eyes to see what he's doing because I'm familiar with the ages that he was, trying to target.
Yeah.
I think with my children, I mean, there were times when I just thought, my God, it's impossible to like study Fred and be a parent because I cannot live up to that. Like I'm impatient and I'm distracted and he was not those, I mean, he might've been, but never on camera, right?
Right.
He was
never distracted saw that.
On camera.
Yeah.
He also didn't have real children in the room when he was on camera, but I think for me with my kids, it has sometimes, it's helped me to slow down and think about what's happening in them because he was so, his kind of orientation when he was with children was always from what's happening inside the child. It wasn't, what do I as an adult need the child to do so that I can get through this moment? It's what's happening for them. And so I think it's helped me to be a little more, I don't know, to try to be a little more attuned to what they're feeling.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Which, yeah, I don't do it all the time, but you know, sometimes.
Yeah. And the thing is, you know, we have the sense that Fred did it all the time, but we know through your research and what we read that that's also not true, but we're called to higher. Fred has called us to higher things.
Sure.
Think,
yeah.
Which is what's also beautiful. Well, I love it. I want to go back and watch the documentary after seeing, the movie where Tom Hanks played Mr. Rogers. I came back home and I wanted to read more, and I was so glad that I was alerted to your book, Exactly As You Are, The Life and Faith of Mr. Rogers. Shay Tuttle, great job on the book, and thank you so much for sharing some of your interactions with all of the Mr. Rogers material and how it's affected you. And just, yeah, thank you for putting this book out into the world. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And to everyone else, I say keep the conversation going.